Autonomous Systems with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hello and welcome to Robots Podcast episode 135. I am Jana and today we will hear from Dr. Jonathan Roberts about autonomous systems research in Australia. But first, here is Christine with the latest news and developments in robotics.
Thank you, Jana. Researchers at US company Boston Dynamics have revealed the Atlas humanoid robot, which will be used by 7 teams competing in the DARPA Robotics Challenge, a competition to remotely control a disaster relief robot. Atlas stands 1.88 meters tall and weighs 150 kilograms. It carries its own onboard computers for real-time control and hydraulic pump to actuate its 28 hydraulic joints. In addition, a tether allows for remote control as well as the transmission of up to 15 kilowatts of power from a remote vehicle. Coinciding with the release of the robot, DARPA also released details on the 8 challenges the team will have to perform with Atlas. Drive a utility vehicle through an obstacle course, traverse 10 stages of increasingly complex terrain on foot, remove debris blocking an entrance, open a door to enter a building, climb an industrial ladder, break through a wall using a light tool, locate and close a valve, and carry, unspool, and connect a fire hose. So far, the teams have been working on controlling the robot in simulation. They will now spend the next months programming and preparing the robot for the first set of challenges, which will be held on December 20th and 21st in Florida. For more details, images, and videos of the Atlas humanoid robot and the DARPA Robotics Challenge, have a look at robohub.org.
The Autonomous Systems Lab at CSIRO in Brisbane, Australia, is developing autonomous technologies to monitor the environment and infrastructure, and to improve safety and operating efficiency in the mining, manufacturing, and agricultural industries. Dr. Jonathan Roberts is director of the Autonomous Systems Lab, leading more than 45 scientists and engineers and a vast range of research projects. Dr. Roberts spoke to our reporter Ron about some of his exciting projects, including the telepresence robot Outback Joe and the Starbug robot.
Good morning, Jonathan, and I'd like to welcome you to the podcast. And if we can start by getting you to introduce yourself to the listeners.
Sure. So my name is Jonathan Roberts, and I am the research director of the Autonomous Systems Lab at CSIRO in Brisbane.
Would you like to explain to our listeners where the Autonomous Systems Laboratory fits within CSIRO?
That's right. So CSIRO is Australia's largest government research organisation, and we have about 6,000 research staff, and we research in all sorts of different areas. My lab is part of a division called the ICT Centre, so Information and Communication Technologies, and the Autonomous Systems Lab then does robotics, does some sensor networks and computer vision.
That's great. So, Jonathan, if you can give us the history of the lab and where it's going.
Sure. So this lab has a long history. People started working here about 19 to 20 years ago, and back then the lab was very focused on mining robotics. So mining robotics in a sense of automating large machines in the open cut coal mining industry. The lab then started to grow, and the researchers here got interested in navigation technology of underground haul trucks in metalliferous mines, and they had a very successful project back in the late 90s and early 2000s to develop a navigation system for a front-end loader underground. That was a successful project, It went on further to be commercialized and is now a commercial product by one of the large underground truck manufacturers. The lab then sort of, went into some other areas. Around that time, we got interested in flying robots. We also got interested in underwater robotics, and we really started to diversify and grow. So in those early days, there were maybe 5 researchers in the lab, and now we have 50. So the lab has sort of grown over those 20 years to be a very significant lab in the world. We also, around the sort of the early 2000s, got into sensor networks, and we realized sensor networks were a nice complement to robotics, and the two could be used very well together. And there's always been this underlying technology of computer vision. Many of the research staff in the lab are very interested in computer vision and real-time vision processing and what vision can do. Although over the years we haven't used it that much in commercial projects, and we've tended to use vision-type techniques, but using laser scanners. Everybody in robotics these days seems to use laser scanners, and we're just the same. We've used them for probably 15 years now.
Now, if we can look at one of your projects within education, the UAV competition called Outback Joe, for instance. This is a very challenging competition for competitors and the competition organisers in general for many reasons.
Yeah, absolutely. So the UAV Challenge, Outback Rescue, is an event that we started, 7 years ago. We started talking about this event. And it was an event that was focused on unmanned aircraft, and it was to target a few barriers to the introduction of unmanned aircraft in civilian applications. So one of those barriers was a lack of, young people knowing about the area. And we knew that there would be an unmanned aircraft industry one day, so we would need to inspire and effectively train a whole sort of new generation of engineers. So a challenge is a great way to do that. Another of the barriers was public perception. Until recently, the public have only had exposure to unmanned aircraft in military settings, so they see those sorts of things on the news, and there hasn't been that much talk about civilian applications. That's changing now, and we do see a lot more talk about civilian applications, and we think that the UAV Challenge has actually helped educate the public. So that was another part. The other part was to get some experience with insurers and insurance. One of the barriers identified many years ago is how do you cover insurance for new application areas? Of course, the insurance industry works usually on precedent, and when something's completely new, it's a little bit hard for them to work out what the risks actually are so that they can come up with sort of informed decisions about whether they should insure, and if they should, and what the premium should be. So we needed some sort of experience and to expose the insurance industry to some sort of realistic scenarios. Also regulation. It's a regulated area, and in most countries in the world, unmanned aircraft operation for commercial use is a regulated area, and there is usually a safety regulator in every country. So this challenge was also an opportunity to work with the safety regulator and sort of understand how operationally you would run such an event in a way that was within the regulations and everybody was comfortable operating such an event. So it was really an event to sort of tackle a whole wide range of barriers that were fairly obvious. And, of course, the final one is really to drive people to develop new technology, and particularly when dealing with a challenge like this, which is open to everybody, it's about getting those people that don't currently work in companies developing robots. They might be hobbyists or amateurs around the world, because some of those people often have out of the box ideas that maybe you wouldn't have if you were working in a large company, and they get a chance to try them out. So we really try to encourage these sort of new ways of doing things. Of course, while staying safe.
Staying within the education theme, one of your current projects is a telepresence robot, which you are trialling within a library.
Sure. Yeah, so we had an idea a few years ago about how to use robots in museums and teaming robots with high-speed broadband. So people are probably aware that about a decade ago, maybe a little longer, there were some groups around the world that actually trialled some so-called museum robots. So these were guide robots that were placed in museums, And as you, when you went to the museum physically, you could be shown around by the robot. These are sort of great projects and really sort of show robots off. But our project isn't about that. Our project is using a robot actually as an avatar for people that can't go to the museum. So we've, you know, paired robots with the internet. And I might point out that actually in those early experiments a decade ago, researchers did use the internet and actually showed a proof of concept where a researcher in a lab actually took a tour of a museum via a robot. But of course, in those days, the internet wasn't widespread. It wasn't in people's homes. It wasn't in people's schools. Or if it was, it was, you know, dial-up modems and was very slow. So what we've done now, we've got very high-speed broadband. And in Australia, the National Broadband Network, the NBN as it's known, is being rolled out, which will give it, you know, all schools and most homes very fast broadband. So we've actually placed two robots in the National Museum of Australia. And these robots are taken around the exhibits in the museum by a human guide. So we haven't actually removed the human here at all. We're actually encouraging the human aspect. And the human guide, instead of talking to a class of students that would normally go to the museum, they instead talk to the robot, and the class of students is, you know, is in their classroom, or they might be at their local library or the school computer room. But they're all, you know, somewhere else. They're not actually in the school. The robot itself has a panoramic video camera as a head, which means that a large panoramic video stream is actually sent to each of the students, and the system supports at the moment a dozen students using the system at the same time. And the students can actually browse that panoramic video on their own computer. So the 12 students use their own individual computers and actually browse the scene as they are talking to the human educator. They can also raise their hands just like they would if they were in the museum and ask a question. And the human educator, you know, has an interface on the robot, and they can see which students want to talk. When a student is talking to the educator, the human educator, all the other students can see that conversation. The human educator also has an ability that when they ask questions, they can get the students all to, you know, answer A, B, C, you know, sort of multiple choice questions, and those questions come up on the student's screen. So you can, the educator can get some feedback. And finally, the system has an extensible camera. So it extends off the robot on a sort of a cord, and the human educator can do close-ups of, you know, the various things they want to talk about. So it's really about using robotics here to enable human-to-human interaction. And rather than what's currently limiting the sort of mobile telepresence market, which is one-to-one robots. We have one robot and one person. This is trying to go that next step, which is one robot and multiple people. And that makes the business case a bit more palatable for places like museums, and it just makes it a little bit more practical. I mean, you could imagine with existing systems, you could buy 12 robots and have 12 robots supporting each of those, you know, each having one robot support each student, so you'd have 12 robots running around, but it starts to get a little bit difficult to handle in the museum. So really we're just trying to simplify things here, and it's been very successful so far, and we're currently in the middle of a 6-month trial of the system.
I noticed in your project listing it mentioned a stealth robot. What is its application? It almost sounds like a military project.
So the so-called stealth robot is a project that a couple of the researchers here are doing to develop a robot that can track and go very close to wildlife, so to animals out in the field. So as I'm sure most listeners are aware, wildlife photography is quite challenging. It's very difficult to get close to some animals when you're trying to photograph them and observe them because they, you know, they can hear you coming, they run away. They smell you, all those things. So there's an idea here to actually use a robot and make it stealthy. So this robot can actually creep up on, you know, on the animals and then take the photography to help documentary makers and also, of course, animal researchers and zoologists. So the robot uses the idea that it's got to, as well as being visually stealthy, actually sort of camouflaged, it's also got to be acoustically stealthy. So it's no good having a robot that sort of blends into the background visually if it makes a whole heap of noise when it's creeping up. You know, these animals obviously have good hearing. So what the researchers are doing is in the visual stealth, they're sort of modelling the environment, and it's got laser scanning systems on board, and the robot actually moves into in front of things that look similar to itself in colour and texture. It also understands shadows, so it deliberately moves itself into shadows. And acoustically, it listens in the environment and tries to model the acoustics of the environment so that it starts to understand the sounds that are happening and also predict sounds that are going to happen. So it sits there and listens, and it might pick up that every so often there's a loud noise, or there's some other animal making a loud noise or something like that, and it predicts that. And when it then starts to hear that noise, it will move during those periods to cover its own noise. And in this way, we're hoping it can actually creep up on these hard to photograph animals. It's only at the early stages of this project, so it's been tested up where the animal is actually a human, and we hope to be testing it up against animals soon.
I see in the list of projects an underwater robot called Starbug. What was its application?
Yes. Okay. So Starbug is the name of our underwater robot. This is a project that's been running for, 7 or 8 years now. Starbug was designed in-house. We tend to, in this laboratory, actually take existing vehicles or machines and turn them into robots, but not in the case of Starbug. So we had some applications where we needed an underwater robot, and we really couldn't find anything off the shelf to do these sorts of jobs. And in CSIRO, we're very interested in environmental monitoring. And environmental monitoring scientists tend not to have massive budgets. So underwater robots, of course, are used by the oil and gas industry and by the military. And both of those areas and industries tend to have much larger budgets than environmental scientists. So the challenge there is to make an affordable underwater robot. And it's got to be affordable in the sense that you've got to be able to afford to lose it every now and again. So that's just a fundamental hazard of underwater robotics, is that every now and again, maybe hopefully only every few years, but it's bound to happen, you're going to lose your robot. It's just one of those things. It's a very challenging environment, and it's when you have an untethered vehicle like this, one day it will happen to you. So you have to have a robot that you can afford every few years to lose. Yeah, so you can wear that financially. So we designed a new robot that was relatively affordable, so the tens of thousands of dollar sort of build range, rather than the hundreds and thousands of dollars or millions of dollars with those other industries I mentioned. And it also, to keep the cost down, it had to be very small so that one person could handle it. So some of the other robots used in oil and gas and military are too large for a person to physically handle. So they then need a crane to lift them in and out of the water, which then often means you need a special boat for the crane. And it starts to get a bit out of control. So once you go over a threshold where a person can't handle it anymore, you suddenly need a special boat, and the costs, you know, get bigger and bigger and bigger. You suddenly need more people, more crew, and it soon escalates and gets even more expensive than you ever dreamed. So it's really important to keep the size of the vehicle so that it can be lifted in and out of the water by a single person. And then you have the flexibility to use any type of boat. You could launch it off the beach. It opens up a whole new world. You can, of course, also then transport it easily around the world. You can put it in a small crate easily, or a suitcase, and you know, it makes the whole thing a lot more flexible. So that's what we did. We designed a one-person liftable robot, which we called Starbug, which is it's a twin-hulled robot. It has an endurance, depending, of course, on the currents, of, you know, sort of 3 or 4 hours. And it's vision-based. So once it goes underwater, it's designed for relatively shallow operations, sort of under 100 metres depth, and it uses vision systems to navigate when it's doing its mission. So it has GPS on its tail, so when it's sitting on the surface and we can talk to it, it's got GPS signals, so it knows where it is, and we can actually talk to it via a radio antenna, which is in its tail. It then dives underneath once it's got its mission, goes to the bottom, and then moves around and uses its camera system to figure out where it's going. So it uses visual odometry, so it tracks what it sees on the bottom of the ocean or a lake, and works out where it's going along. At this time, it's completely autonomous. We don't have any communication links with Starbug once it's underwater. And then a few hours later, we, of course, cross our fingers and hope it comes back. And, of course, most of the times it does. And it pops back up, gets a GPS lock, lets everyone know it's back, sort of figures out where the currents would have been from the any errors it's built up in its odometry over the time, and then, you know, maybe goes back and does more of the mission, or it's retrieved by the one person over the side of the boat. And it's been a very, very, very successful project. It actually won the National Engineering Excellence Award in 2006, I think it was. So, you know, it's been a real success.
I see the lab has worked on an unmanned automatic helicopter robot. What is its application?
Yes, so unmanned aircraft is something that's interested us for over a decade now. We've been very interested in, again, autonomy and how you actually have these unmanned aircraft fly by themselves. And we're particularly interested in applications where you don't have very good communications between the ground operator operating the vehicle and the vehicle itself. There are many applications where you do have very good communications, and you can have things like backup pilots or even, you know, very high-level supervision where you're actually supervising the robot and even remotely controlling flying robots. That's commonly done. But that all relies on very good communications. We're more interested in those applications where you don't have very good communications or you lose communications completely for significant periods of time. We're currently working on a project where we're developing a demonstrator rotary wing unmanned aircraft that flies over rainforests. So in Australia, we have a particular application where we need to spot invasive weeds in rainforests. So we have many invasive weeds in Australia, and currently people fly in manned helicopters. They fly over rainforests and they look out the door and spot where these invasive weeds are, plot that on a map, and then teams go in later and clean them up and remove the weeds. And generally that sort of data is also used then by the scientists to figure out how the weeds are spreading. Now, that task is something that people would rather not do. Because if you imagine flying over rainforests in a helicopter, if you have any mechanical issue at all, there's nowhere to land. Normally when you're flying a helicopter over cities or, you know, over normal countryside, if you have a mechanical issue, the pilot looks for the nearest place to land, and there's normally plenty of places to land, and they put the helicopter down and everybody's fine. Of course, if you're over a very big expanse of rainforest, there's not many options. And so it's one of those applications where currently people do it because it's an important thing to do. But if we had a way of doing it without putting people in the air, then we should do that. So it's now seen that the technology is getting mature enough that we can start thinking about actually having robot aircraft do this job. So that's what we're doing at the moment. So we have a project with the Queensland government here in Australia, along with Boeing Research Technology and Queensland University of Technology. And that project is all about developing and showing how you can develop an autonomous aircraft to do this sort of mission in mountainous rainforest areas where communications is not guaranteed.
Expanding on the theme, I believe some work was done in the agricultural area on selective micro-spraying for invasive weeds. Is this something that your team has looked at?
Yes. Yeah, no, there has been work done, not by us on spraying, but it is a popular topic and application used for unmanned aircraft. Agriculture generally, I think, is going to be one of the early adopters of unmanned aircraft. A lot of agriculture these days would like to have frequent aerial photography. It can help with, you know, the farmer actually make decisions about how the various crops are going. or in a livestock world, you know, world actually finding out where animals are in these incredibly large properties, particularly in Australia. So I think we will find agriculture will be a very early adopter. Some of the agricultural applications as well are not so challenging in the communications aspect in these very large areas. The terrain is often very flat, so communications is usually very good. So, again, it's another reason, I think, why agriculture will be an early adopter of unmanned aircraft.
You spoke to me in an earlier conversation about the hurdles in the commercialisation of UAVs, the restrictions, legal and insurance ground that still needs to be covered.
Yes, I can talk about that. So one of the issues, of course, with unmanned aircraft is that it's a regulated business. And it is a regulated business in most countries around the world. So here in Australia, it's a regulated business. So if you're to use an unmanned aircraft for commercial gain, then you have to work, of course, within the relevant commercial regulations. And currently that means that you need to have an operator's certificate to operate that vehicle. And that's something that's granted by the Civil Aviation and Safety Authority here in Australia. And currently, I understand there are about 30 to 40 licensed operators of unmanned aircraft in Australia. So one of the barriers to farmers using and agriculturists generally using these aircraft is the business model around how they would use these sorts of aircraft. Some people think that the farmer would maybe just go and buy one of these aircraft and then just pop it out every week or two and use it. But that's not clear quite with the current regulations and then the business model how that would work, because if they were to do that currently, they would need to obviously be licensed and have an operator certificate, and that is probably too onerous for most farmers. I think that's unlikely they would do that under the current regulations. So other options would be maybe there would be a local operator of unmanned aircraft that would provide a service to farmers in their region. That seems like a realistic scenario, and I can see that happening. And, you know, there might be specialists that come in and actually move around the district as well, so not be local, but, you know, have a schedule where they actually go around and take aerial photography at different farms. But currently, it's very unlikely that farmers can stay within the regulations by simply purchasing these unmanned aircraft themselves and using them. That doesn't really seem possible. Of course, there's every chance that the regulations will adapt over time and change, and then maybe you know, in the future that will be possible as everybody, the public, the farmers, the operators, the regulators all get to understand how these devices work, understand all the risks a little bit better, and I'm sure, you know, that the whole world will adapt accordingly. But currently that is a little bit of a barrier to sort of the adoption of these aircraft.
I see you are investigating locomotion systems, specifically a hexapod robot. Is this for different terrain work?
Yes. Yeah, I can talk about legged robotics. So because we're very interested in environmental monitoring and using robots to do environmental monitoring, we've come to the realization, of course, that you can fly robots through forests and things like that, although that's very challenging. You can, in certain areas, in certain agricultural settings, of course, you can use wheeled or tracked robots to move your robot around. But, of course, in a lot of the areas we want to operate, particularly in foresty sort of areas or areas with very rough terrain, wheeled or tracked robots are not going to cut it. They're simply not going to work. So there is, of course, a need to use some other form of locomotion to actually move your robot around. And legged robots seem like an obvious solution for a couple of reasons. So the first very obvious reason is that legged robots can actually step over things, and they can operate on very rough terrain, sort of rocky terrain, very steep slopes. They can reconfigure themselves into all sorts of different and use different gates to actually walk across the environment. But the second reason is actually not so obvious, but it's a robot with lots of legs is also has built-in redundancy. So when these robots go around the environment, and hopefully they're deployed for many days or weeks at a time, again, it's inevitable that there'll be some, something will go wrong with one of the legs. A servo motor will break, some sort of sensor will break. Something might snap off. There'll be some kind of failure. Having lots of legs, six or eight legs, actually gives you that redundancy. So if you break a leg, you can still carry on. And of course, we see this in insects. Everybody's seen a spider with seven legs or six legs, or a fly with a leg missing, and they still operate and work. And it's a great thing to model our robots on, I think. It's built-in redundancy. So that's really the reason we're exploring these legged robots, is those two things, just to get over rough terrain and also have built-in redundancy.
In what direction do you think future robotics will be heading towards?
Yeah, I think the future of robotics is very interesting because a whole lot of things are now coming together, which I think will start to accelerate robotics generally. There's these three aspects of robotics that people are familiar with, which is the idea of sensing, thinking, and acting. And those three things can be thought of as a feedback loop. So a robot has to sense the world. It then has to think and figure out what was in the world, what it needs to do right now to meet its mission, and then it's got to act. So it's got to move. It's got to move itself. It's got to move something. It's got to do something. And then that's a loop, and then it's got to sense again, and around it goes. We're fairly, researchers around the world are fairly good, and it's fairly mature field in the acting bit. I think the locomotion aspect and the control aspect is getting fairly mature. I mean, we see humanoid robots now with incredibly sophisticated control systems, and all that actuation is getting really, really quite good. The sensing is also starting to mature. We're seeing, of course, with ubiquitous cameras everywhere now, that there's a lot of people developing all sorts of computer vision techniques, not necessarily for robotics, but for mobile devices. And I think we'll see some of that, some of those algorithms and ideas then fed into robotics. We've already seen laser scanners used widely, and we're seeing structured light sensors like the Kinect being used. And the sensing side is also starting to really mature. It's the middle bit. It's the in the sense, think, and act. It's the thinking bit that's still really hard, and that's not surprising. Everybody's always known that's very hard. And also, without the good sensing, the thinking bit's often is a bit of a challenge. So I see, as we see that the sensing part get more mature, the thinking part will mature also. The other really interesting thing that's happened recently, which I think will change robotics fundamentally, is that now we don't have to do the thinking part on the robot. So, of course, in the early days of robotics, we assumed that everything would have to happen on the robot. And thinking of animals and ourselves, we were all about replicating the brain, and we would have to put our robot brain, it would naturally, of course, be on the robot. This was before the days of the internet and the cloud. Of course, the world has changed. We don't need to constrain our thinking now to be on the robot. If that robot's got a high-speed internet connection, it's got some sort of wireless connection to the internet, a lot of the thinking can actually happen off the robot, and it can, the robot can look things up on the internet. Robots can share information. They can add things to databases. And I think this teaming up of the internet and high-speed internet with robotics will start to accelerate that whole thinking part. And I think in the next decade we'll see some major uplift in that area. So I really see that's what's changed and is changing, is this whole, the internet, I think, will be a significant influence on robotics in the future.
Most people think of robotics in the area of manufacturing robots, the large robots that are used in painting and assembling cars. Where would we be heading to create more interactive, more robots that are utilized in a close proximity to humans?
Absolutely, and that is also the next challenge in robotics, is getting robots to work with people in close proximity. So everybody is fairly familiar with the concept of robots, for example, in factories where they're behind screens and they're, you know, they're welding, they're putting parts together, they're doing assembly tasks, but they're very separate from the people. And that's with good reason. You know, they're very fast moving, they're bulky. You know, that if you were close, you could get seriously injured, obviously. Of course, robotics needs to get, when it starts to move into different realms close to people, it has to become inherently safe or inherently safer. So there's this concept of lightweight robotics developing, where robots will be, you know, will be allowed to work with people in incredibly close proximity, and the world is moving that way. So research is being done specifically in that area about how you make robot actuators safe, so you know they can work next to people. How you make mobile platforms safe, so they can operate around people, and how you generally make the environment more intelligent so that people and the robots can actually work together and touch and be very close. So that's I see as a really big area. That will be a two-phased approach. I think we'll see people working with these robots in a controlled environment. So this would say be in warehouses or factories, and they're the people they're working with the robots are trained people. So they're people that are familiar with the robots. They've had training about the robots. They know how to work with the robots, and that's what as well helps keep them safe. The next phase after that will be where we aim to have robots working with the general public who are not trained specifically to work with those robots. And that's a way off yet, I think, of course. We have to sort of solve the first problem first, but that's where we're aiming for, is actually to be able to have robots working amongst people that are not trained specifically in how to work with those robots.
In rethinking the current climate of mass manufacturing, where do you think we would best concentrate our efforts?
Yes, so in Australia, as you mentioned, we're seeing a big debate now about the direction the manufacturing industry should go in, and it would appear that the manufacturing industry in Australia is likely in the future to not focus on mass production as much as it does now, but to focus more on this mass customization. So again, the internet is changing the way people can buy products, and this idea of customization is coming to the forefront now, where you can, when you order something, you can order variations on things. You don't just order, the difference used to be you could order a different color, you know, of whatever you wanted to buy. Now you can potentially, and in the future, you know, customize things a lot more than that. And I think we'll see manufacturing have to cope with that. And it's a potential niche sort of area, particularly for Australia, where we can focus on this mass customization idea, which by its very nature will mean that there won't be as many of these production lines that everybody's used to. But instead, we'll have to do shorter runs of more customizable manufacturing, where you might have a factory that every week is actually reconfigured. You know, the machines all move around, different robots come out of the cupboard to do different things, and the factory is effectively reconfigured on a very frequent basis to make a smaller run of different things. Even within that run of product, there might be, you know, a quite a wide variation. And it's seen that robotics is really and lightweight robotics is a solution, well, one of the solutions to that customization issue, and how you rearrange your manufacturing process on a far more rapid basis. Of course, in the things that people are used to now, production line type manufacture, you might not change the production line for years, years and years. And it seems like that will inevitably change, and robotics would appear to be a solution.
On the humanities side, what do you say to people who worry about their job and ask the question, will robotics and automation replace them in their job, or is it simply to create a new job?
Yeah, no, we do. Of course, people always talk about that, and we have people talk about that, and everybody within the industry, I guess, talks about that all the time. And we always look particularly to the past to figure out what the future will be like. And it's very clear that that, you know, as we've had mechanization go through many industries, kind of jobs change and the roles people do in those industries change as well. So I think robotics is extremely likely to change the way people do things, and for good reasons. There's always a driver in industries to make things safer, and everybody agrees with that. There's really no debate, and that inevitably changes the way people do jobs to make things safer. And we also see that this sort of technology will sort of empower people more. So we think that the sorts of robots we're developing aren't really aimed to replace a worker. They're aimed at making a worker more effective. It's very clear that robotics, you know, is not as advanced as a lot of people think. And a lot of people, of course, are influenced by science fiction, and they think that robots are far more capable than they really are. Now, of course, they're capable of certain things. They're very precise. You know, they can be more precise than a person. They can be stronger than a person. They can pick hotter things up than a person can. But they don't have that capacity to think and adapt and change and all those things. And a person does. So we really think that the way of the future is to have the human use their brilliant brain and problem-solving abilities to actually work with the dumber robots that have those abilities of precision and not getting tired and strength and speed and all those sorts of things. So because we think that the manufacturing industry is going to have to become more flexible and less focused on production line things, I actually think the human will be needed more and more, not less. If everything was just a production line and we were pumping out millions of exactly the same thing, then you know, you could see robots would dominate. But it doesn't appear that the world's going that way. It appears that the world wants to have more customized products, and people, you know, want things more their way, and that will need flexibility. And robots currently aren't good at flexibility. People are good at that. So we think. Yeah, we don't think that in the manufacturing industry there's going to be big shifts in the number of workers. We think that those workers may end up doing things in slightly different ways, and that's as has been for centuries. That's sort of inevitable. But we don't think that the number of workers will actually reduce. And the other, of course, thing we want to do in Australia is have an industry that actually builds these robots and designs them. So as well as using them, we don't just want to be users of these new types of robots. We want to have an industry that actually develops this stuff and actually makes it. So, you know, we want to increase jobs in that particular area too.
And on behalf of the podcast, I would like to thank you very much for your time, Jonathan.
Thanks a lot, Ron. It's been a pleasure.
And that concludes today's episode. If you want to have a closer look at Outback Joe, the telepresence robot, or any of the other projects featured in this episode, check out our website at robotspodcast.com. We'll be back with another episode in 2 weeks' time. Until then, goodbye. Autonomous Systems with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.